Now, as you know, Brian Hughes is a regular contributor to this program with his detailed legal advice on a whole variety of issues. And Brian has now written a book, A Law Unto Myself. And although by virtue of the title, you could be forgiven for the thinking that the book is all about Brian's experiences as a solicitor, whilst there are references to his work in the legal sphere, there's a lot more besides. Actually, the book is, to all intents and purposes, an autobiography and exposes a whole new Brian. The book's full of humour, including, as it does, details of the practical jokes for which it seems Brian was renowned in his formative years. And boy, you've had some incredible experiences, haven't you, Brian?
Well, yes, I have, rather, Scott. A lot of people I've regaled these stories to have said you ought to put them in a book, which is why I've done it. Yes, you're quite right.
Well, there's no way we could have hoped to cover all of them today, as long before you became a qualified solicitor and set up your own legal practices. Incredibly, you've been in military intelligence, you've run your own travel agency, stood for election, even coming close to unseating a very well-known sitting member of parliament, worked alongside many illustrious peers and peeresses, and that's even without mentioning your first cousin, Dudley Moore. And there's one letter of the experience related in your book that I'd really like to explore in some detail, as I think it might help us to discover the real Brian Hughes. So perhaps we could firstly go back to the National Service days that you spent in military intelligence in Cyprus, where you came face-to-face to death on a couple of occasions. So tell us about that, if you will.
Well, yes, indeed. One of the things we had to do was go up in the mountains and try and track down terrorists. And one evening, I was on a mountain pass with Jim Herlihy, who was an ex-sergeant from New Scotland Yard. He'd been in the SBS, the Special Boat Service. Mm-hmm. He was about as tough a person as you could imagine. And we were hoping to ambush a terrorist on the path. He told me to keep an eye out from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. in the morning while he had a doze. And in fact, at about 1 o'clock in the morning, I heard somebody coming up the path through this mountain pass. And I bent over to tap Jim Herlihy on the shoulder. And unfortunately, my boots clinked because I put Blakeys in them and the steps stopped, footsteps.
What are Blakeys?
Blakeys are things that you used to put in your boots to prevent wear. Uh-huh. And miners and other people used to do it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to prevent wear on my core boots, which I'd taken into the army.
Yeah.
Being crafty, I decided to take an extra pair of boots, which stood me in very good stead on parades. But anyway, that's another story. Mm-hmm. But what happened was that the footsteps stopped, and Jim said, okay, Brian, you stand across the path, and if he comes your way, you get him, and Abdul and I will go off and try and find him. And in point of fact, I had a Sterling submachine gun in my hand and I cocked it. And it was pitch black. And about a few minutes later, a shadow appeared in front of me. I could just detect a person.
Yes.
And I had to decide whether it was the terrorist or Jim or Abdul. And I decided to say, who's there? And it was Abdul, which was fortunate, because he said if I hadn't spoken, he'd have shot me. and he, if he'd been the terrorist, would probably have shot me. But I did have my finger on the trigger. As I was shot, I would almost certainly have got him as well. So that was a pretty hairy moment.
But you've had a much closer call with death more recently, haven't you?
Yes, indeed. I was swimming in the Brentwood School pool. I used to go there after work to try and balance off mental and physical exercise and exertion. I used to do 30 lengths after work, and I got to the end of length 11, and I disappeared from view. And the pool attendant got down from his high chair and went to the edge, and there I was on the bottom of the pool at the deep end. He dived in, fished me out with another person, gave me artificial respiration, and I was taken to the Queen's Hospital in Romford. Mm. They did a CT scan on me, and they found that I'd had a brain hemorrhage. My heart stopped at 10 p.m. They got it going. Stopped again at 2 midnight. They got it going. And then they said to my late wife, look, the CT scan shows no sign of brain activity, so do you want us to resuscitate a third time? Because that's all we can do under the NHS guidelines. She said yes, and my heart stopped at 2 a.m. in the morning, and they got it going again with some difficulty. At that point, they asked whether I had any religious affiliation, and my late wife said, yes, C of E. So at 20 past 3 in the morning, the priest came in and gave me the last rites. Now, strangely, when he gave me the last rites, they took the tube out of my throat, which was giving me intense support. And my son said to me, that's actually seemed to help you. The doctors, however, said, we're putting Brian in a side room. He'll pass away peacefully within the next 2 hours. And the whole family sat around until 6 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't. The priest had left by this time. So I survived, and the doctors came in, by the way, and said, oh, is he still alive? We thought he'd be dead by now, which was very charitable of them. But anyway, 9 days later, they operated on my brain. They'd emptied all the blood out. They repaired my ruptured artery in the brain, a bit like repairing a puncture from the inside. And my memory returned, and my late wife said to me, you know, Brian, during those 9 days, you were such a nice person. you told the nurses what a fantastic job they were doing. You told us all how much you loved us. And now I'm afraid you're back to normal. The only galling thing about the whole business was that she decided to run my practice in my absence. And it actually made more profit while I was away than when I was there. But apart from that, okay.
Now, I raise these incidents because I specifically wanted to talk to you about the amazing number of paranormal happenings that you've experienced, from haunted houses to possessed beds, to mention just two. But there are others as well that feature in your book, so I'd like to know more about these and what effect these experiences have had on you, and how on earth can a bed be haunted?
Well, that's an interesting story, but I've always felt that I'm vaguely psychic. In fact, that feeling came to me when I was at university and I organized a prize draw for the Poppy Appeal. And I was in a pub one night selling tickets, and I decided to buy the final ticket because I hadn't paid for a ticket for my own raffle. And believe it or not, when the prizes were drawn, at a certain point, I was totally convinced that I would win a prize, and I put my hand on the person next to me, who looked at me rather strangely, and sure enough, I won the prize. Now, that was the first indication. Since then, I was in the army, and I was in a deserted churchyard one evening as a technical assistant, Royal Artillery, and I was asked to do the midnight to 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 in the morning watch in a derelict churchyard. And the mist was swirling around this November evening. I went outside with a torch, and I thought that a ghostly magwitch would probably jump up from behind one of the tombstones. But in fact, it was the friendliest place I've ever been in, which again was very strange. Now, as far as the haunted bed and the haunted house are concerned, the haunted bed, I decided that I would have to buy a bed for my Greek brother, Babis. Babis and I became very friendly during the years we worked together. And he used to come over in November to do the accounts with me. And it's perhaps worth mentioning that he would bring two sets of accounts. And one was from him and myself, and the other one was for the tax inspector. And I said, Babis, these accounts for the tax inspector show exactly half what we've earned. And he said, that's right, Brian. He said, because the tax inspector won't believe us and we'll double it. So I said, in that case, Babis, we will finish up paying what we should be paying. And he said, that's right. Now, he was short, fat, hairy, chain-smoked, and when he came over in November every year with the books, he wanted me to provide a bottle of whiskey to keep him warm during the night. And I bought this bed at an auction sale in Clare in Suffolk. I bid for it. I decided at the last moment to go up and bid for it and bought it. didn't know how the hell I was going to get it back to Billericay, but there we are. But when he arrived, I told him I'd bought this lovely bed for him. And for the first couple of nights, it was fine. On Saturday morning, I went downstairs to pay the milkman. And I'm afraid I didn't take enough money downstairs to pay for the milk bill. So I went upstairs. And on my way upstairs, I noticed all Babis's sheets and blankets in the hall. I put them in his bedroom. He was fast asleep. And went to the office. This was a Saturday morning when I worked Saturdays. And I went back at lunchtime and said, Babis, I found all your sheets and blankets in the hall. That was strange. I thought you must have wrapped them round yourself to go to the loo downstairs when you didn't realise there was one upstairs, loo upstairs. He said, Brian, I've lived with my parents in the flat for the last 30 years. He said, if I sleepwalked, my parents would have told me. So we couldn't explain that. A couple of days later, he rang me at the office on a Tuesday and said, you must come back to the flat at once. I went back and went into his bedroom, and he pointed at his suitcase and he said, feel those clothes. Well, I did, and it was water. It wasn't what I half expected, perhaps had a whittle in them during the night. And I said, well, Babis, I can't really explain that, except that when you came here, you put your suitcase under the window, and the window was a swivel window, and it rained, and the water must have come into your clothes. In that case, the floor on either side would be wet. We felt the floor bone dry. He came to the conclusion that spirits came in through the window. Now, the British Tourist Board did a great job in Athens, and they published an article in one of the magazines about Anne Boleyn walking through the Tower of London with her head under her arm. And he said, spirits come in through the window. That's the only answer. We must keep the window shut. So I said, OK, Lewis, we'll keep the window shut. And then the following Saturday, he rang me in a state of great concern, said, Brian, you must come back to the flat at once. And I went back, and he was fully dressed, standing in the kitchen, and he said, come upstairs. And I went up to his bedroom, and he said, when I went to bed last night, I smoked three cigarettes, and I put the ashtray and I put the ashtray under the chair by the bed, and my cigarettes and cigarette lighter on the chair. When I woke up in the morning, my cigarettes and cigarette lighter had gone, and the ashtray had gone. So I got out of bed, I found the cigarette lighter and the ashtray under the chair and the ashtray in the middle of the bed. And he said, and that's not all. And he threw back the sheets, and there were the cigarette stubs and the ash from his ashtray right up the centre of the bed.
Extraordinary.
Well, yes, exactly. He said, you must call the priest. So I rang the priest, David Greaves, and David Greaves said, Brian, there's a lot of psychic phenomena in Billericay at the moment. He said, I will come and exercise the bed if you like, but I think, I'll come if you have any more problems. Well, that didn't make Babis very happy at all. He said, we must investigate the bed. So we took the mattress off, and there under the mattress was one of those brown tags that you attach to luggage, and it said, Miss A.E. Clements, deceased. So he said, take the tag off. This must be, we are being haunted by a Miss Clements. So I did, went back downstairs, and I said, look, hang on a minute, Babis, I'll just have a word with Miss Clements. And I shouted up the stairs and said, look, Miss Clements, I don't like you haunting my guests, and if I have any more trouble from you, I'll have to have you exorcised. This didn't make Babis very happy at all. And in point of fact, he left very shortly after. Yeah. And on all future occasions when we did the accounts, I had to go out to Athens to look at them.
Oh, dear.
But he was a short, fat, hairy Greek who chain-smoked, went to bed in his vest and pants, and drank whiskey before he went to sleep. I could quite understand Miss Clements feeling a bit put out, because she was an elderly spinster who had apparently died in it. I did actually then get a young Indian guy to sleep in the bed on a Rotary student exchange visit, And I told him that I had this lovely bed for him and hoped he'd have a good night's sleep, and I crossed my fingers. And the next morning he came down and I asked him whether he'd slept okay, and he said, oh yes, I had a wonderful night's sleep. So he obviously had the approval of Miss Clements. I've not had any problems with Miss Clements ever since, and I think my little chap probably did the trick.
Incredible. Now, I know you've had a load of different psychological experiences, but I think we'll put those on one side for a moment, because I particularly want to raise the subject of the couple that you write about called the Robinsons, who you say their obvious love for each other had a profound effect on you, making you appreciate that the accumulation of wealth, possessions and status was nowhere near as important as love and contentment. Who were these people and how did you come to meet them?
Well, when I went to university, they had an outreach program. They allowed students to go out and talk to elderly couples just to keep them company. And really, it was a way of, what's the word, keeping them in touch with what was going on. And I cycled out to Hills Road in Cambridge to a very old block of tenement houses. They were just little terraced houses. Mm. And I went in and Mrs. Robinson said, oh, it's so good to see you. I've bought a packet of biscuits for you. And to me, that was remarkably generous because it must have cost her a shilling and they obviously didn't have a bean. And they were sitting huddled round the fire in black clothes trying to keep warm. And we talked for a couple of hours, and they said, we'd love to see you again. And I said, yes, I'll be back. But I walked outside that place and cycled back to college, and I thought, my goodness me, all my life has been predicated towards achievement and making money and being successful. And here I see these old people very much in love with each other and very happy despite their poverty. And I didn't have the nerve to go back. It was very callow of me, very wrong, but I didn't go back. But they haunted me. And when I finished up divorced in 1975 and really, what's the word, miserable with life, I remembered the Robinsons and I thought, well, I'm going to live the way they lived. I'm not going to worry too much about wealth. I'm going to stay in Billericay, do things for the community, and take it from there. Now, my second wife always used to get on at me and say, if you went to the city, you could earn three times more than you're earning now and be very successful. And I thought, well, yeah, I could be, but I wouldn't have got the satisfaction out of life that I'm getting out of it now. Mm-hmm. So the Robinsons, they came back to me some years later, and I geared my life to the way they lived.
Now, clearly your near-death experiences and nearly losing your eyesight, which is mentioned in the book, have obviously left their mark on you. So can I ask you to explain how your life experiences have affected your attitude to the different religions of the world, spirituality, and how you perceive man's place in the universe?
Well, that's very profound. I'm not the Archbishop of Canterbury.
But you're
yeah, yeah. No, what happened was that when I was at school, I was editor of the Classical Society magazine, and a chap called McFarger came up and said, would I put an article in the magazine about comparative religion? And my co-editor said, if you put that article in the magazine, I'll resign. So I accepted his resignation and put the article in the magazine. And it said basically that no one religion in the world is the right religion. Everything is an approximation. And in fact, that was borne out when I was at university when I read about a guy called Grotius. He was an international lawyer in the 17th century. And he said that everything is an approximation to the absolute. And I've always taken that as my guide and arbiter. So in other words, all the religions of the world, they can't just be one, right? They've all got one thing in common, and that's an element of spirituality. And we're all born with an element of spirituality, and we can either reject it or accept it. And when we die, I think our spirituality is sort of recycled.
Mm-hmm.
I came to that conclusion because I was had a regression in my 40s, and I was regressed to somebody else's previous life, and it was quite fascinating, and I'm going to write a book about it. So, in answer to your question, we're on this planet for a very short time.
Yep.
It's a very small planet in a very vast universe. There's got to be a creator of some type who's created us and created the universe.
Mm.
We live in two dimensions. We really live in one dimension, a living dimension, and a spiritual dimension. And I think the spiritual dimension often survives, as per my ghosts, Miss Clements and the lady who haunted my house and various other times. So that's my view.
Well, as I think you'll have gathered from our chat today, Brian has lived a life bringing full of all sorts of experiences that most of us would not expect to encounter in several lifetimes, from life in military intelligence, running an international travel organisation, producing handbooks for student travellers, working in stockbroking, organising collections to support families of striking miners, establishing a running club, founding a firm of solicitors, standing for Parliament and still managing to seek out how man fits the whole scheme of things. The book is a treasure trove which might help you to learn from lessons that he learned the hard way and maybe benefit from those lessons yourself. So, Brian, why don't you remind us the book details, the price, and where you can get a copy?
Yes, it's called A Law Unto Myself. You can get it from Amazon. It's $8.99. You can get hardback from major bookshops, Foyles, Waterstones, etc. That's $16.99. I went into lots of shops to see how books were priced.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty well all books, paperbacks, of an autobiographical nature are priced at about $8.99.
Mm.
And the hardbacks at $16.99, although very often they put £20 reduced to $16.99. So I decided to follow the tried and tested pricing structure. And as I say, you could look it up on Amazon, get it from Amazon, $8.99, and it's delivered very quickly. And I hope people will find it useful to them in their lives, because I'm coming up to 84, and I thought this was a parting shot. And
I hope you'll be around for a lot longer.
We'll see.
Yeah.
But it's perhaps people can learn from the mistakes I've made, but yet find the book interesting.
Good stuff. Thank you very much indeed, Brian. Thanks a lot.
Across Brentwood and Billericay, this is Phoenix FM. On the hour, across Brentwood and Billericay, this is Phoenix.